So this is what we ended on, which is burning. Again, overall, a burning can be useful in certain situations, like I mentioned, coastal situations where you can't get in a disc. Somebody came up and mentioned that it could be used for breeding waterfowl management, especially in the Midwest and the breeding areas of the prairie regions, to maintain native warm season grasses for nesting cover indeed. So overall, it's used in areas where you can't get a disc or that you're trying to do terrestrial management for waterfowl. As far as, again, sending back succession, it is not successful, nearly as successful as if you disc. You have to break that seed bank, y'all. See, these plants have, many of the later successional plants have allelopathic effects. That means that as their vegetation is breaking down, it's producing a chemical that inhibits the germination of other plants. So the only way that you can give those plants that are in the seed bank, the annual plants, a chance, is if you remove those and you break the seed bank and you expose those seeds. That's the most effective way, okay? So, is that clear?
What's that called?
Allelopathy. See if I can remember how to spell that. Oh, I need a darker thing. Allelopathic. That's right. It has growth inhibiting capabilities on other plants besides itself. Sure. Yep. It is right. So a lot of the perennials, like smartweed, can have allelopathic effects. It's just simply a competitive strategy to try to prevent other things from growing around you. And so what's that? Smartweed. Yes, exactly. So the allelopathic ones are the perennial plants. Those tend to have more allelopathic capabilities, and they reproduce vegetatively. So you have this vegetation that just there, and as it decomposes, releasing these chemicals, plus it can reproduce vegetatively. It doesn't have to worry about the seed bank being broken. Plus the duff that's created, the detritus that's created, acts as a shading effect on the seed bank. So the bottom line is you need to get rid of that vegetation and break the seed bank in order to have the setback succession. Again, the most effective way is through disking. And also burning, the other benefit of that is if you have really rank vegetation, you can burn first and then disk, and it'll really set back succession. Okay. So, good? All right. Other manipulations, and this was brought up. What about herbicide? Herbicides can be used to control vegetation. Again, it's not very good at setting back succession, but what it is good at is controlling nuisance plants. So that's what you want to use herbicide for. Common plants that will colonize wetlands that tend to shade out your grasses. In the foreground here, that brown stuff that you're seeing here is grass. These are all annual grasses. The green stuff is Sespania. And when it gets really, really dense, so that's the hemp coffee weed, or what is it called?
River hemp,
okay. So Sespania, and when it gets really, really dense, it's a broadleaf emergent legume, and it shades out these grasses. So if you see it getting established in your wetland, so you know, when you do your manipulations and or even your drawdowns, you want to get out there and check to see what plants are responding. Yeah, lots of grasses. If you have Cespania out there, or another one is cocklebur, it'll get out and it'll shade out those grasses and really reduce the seed production, then you're going to want to control it. And they can establish in early succession. So you have to really keep an eye on it. Well, fortunately, 2,4-D, trade name, at least the one you're using in wetlands, is Renovate-3, is very good at killing broadleaf emergents such as Cespania and cocklebur, and not killing the grasses. Okay, so it selectively kills those. So that's a good one. 2,4-D is not very expensive either. A non-selective herbicide that you can use is a glyphosate herbicide, and again, the Rodeo is the aquatic label. Roundup is the terrestrial label. You cannot apply Roundup. It's not approved to apply to aquatic system. Rodeo is, though. It's glyphosate based. That pretty much kills pretty much anything. Glyphosate does have negative impacts on amphibians. It's been shown to result in reduced growth, reduced survival, and malformations in larval amphibians and post-metamorphic amphibians. In fact, we have a guest lecture that's coming at the beginning of April that's coming to the university. He's going to be guest lecturing in the amphibians class, but also doing a university-wide seminar on the effects of Roundup on amphibians. His name's Dr. Rick Relier. That's April 3rd and 4th. Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'll get you all the dates. It'll be it's during my amphibians class, which is on a Thursday night at 5 o'clock, and it's going to be in here. And so you guys, you know, if you're in town, you'll be able to make it. And then there's a Friday afternoon seminar that's on main campus that he's given. You can get extra credit for going for both of those, no doubt. In fact, we'll strike a deal because I'll give you something like, if you're interested in doing that, I'll give you 1% increase in your grade, which is a pretty fair deal because you have to volunteer 8 hours for 1.5%. So just coming for that time period to come to Dr. Relier's talks, absolutely. Yeah, I will. Yeah. Okay. Okay, if you have a really stubborn exotic, Mazatir is a pretty darn good herbicide. Habitat is the aquatic label, and it's often used to control invasive exotic plants such as alligator weed. In fact, Mazapure is the only herbicide that we've been very successful at all at controlling alligator weed. It's an evil plant. The other thing is with some exotics, like alligator weed, if you disc it, you piss it off. That there's no doubt. You just make it, it will reproduce vegetatively. So you cut it, and it just is like, oh, cool, now I'm 500 plants. And I mean, it's seriously. So, you know, you have to be very careful when you start to deal with exotic plants about what you do. And so disking isn't very effective at controlling at least alligator weed. The other thing, remember, you can do with cocklebur, what did we talk about you could do? You could flood it. So you could irrigate if you had that capability, and you'll kill it, and you won't kill your grasses, your hydrophytes. Price increases going from the cheapest being 2,4-D down to Mazapure. I don't have those numbers exactly, but... I do. On the back of the handout that is our abstract, the one that Kaminsky and I have here on the mechanical manipulations. The back of that, you can see different herbicides that are listed and what they can be used for. They all require a surfactant, and I was talking with the guys over at Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge, and they often use a methylated seed oil surfactant. So a methylated seed oil surfactant tends to work pretty good. So just FYI. All right. Excuse me. So the next thing is, well, you've been talking about just managing what is there. Next thing is really, all right, what about plants and stuff? First and foremost, as far as planting, buying moist soil seeds of whatever and broadcasting them, planting natural plants is probably not necessary, y'all, unless you're in an area where it's maybe been in agricultural production for, you know, 10 years. There's still going to be a seed bank there, probably of viable seeds. The only way of knowing is if you have one of those areas and you maybe restore it and you start flooding it, is flood it and see what happens, see what comes up. But I wouldn't go and start spending, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars on seed when you probably have that already in the seed bank. I just got this when I went up to for lunch, received a catalog here, wholesale nursery catalog from Environmental Concern Incorporated, Native Wetland Plants 2008 just came in. And you can go through here and they've got a bunch of wetland plants. Now, if you had a depauperate seed source, and you didn't have things coming up, my first recommendation would be go to a wetland in your area and literally go out there and try to harvest the seed. Go out there and mow it or cut some stuff. And I mean, maybe that's just not very efficient. You don't have the time. In that case, all right, if you want to do some broadcast seeding, then fair enough. Go ahead and you can, when you draw down, you can broadcast seed. But get plants there from your region, okay, at least species from your region. Interestingly, I was looking through here, and just so that you know, I'm not making you learn stuff that is not used. They have on here wetland indicator status, and they have the hydrophyte classification, OBL, FACW, FACW+, etc. So I'll pass this around just so you can take a look at it. And now, what is often done with moist soil management and can, again, really be help increase the productivity of an overall complex is incorporating agriculture. And one of the easiest ways is using agricultural varieties of hydrophytes, such as Japanese millet. This is this looks very similar to barnyard grass. And sort of similar to Walter's millet, except Walter's millet has really long awns. Do you often know Walter's millet? Okay, yeah. So really produces a lot of seed. this seeding rate is a little high, 40 kilograms per hectare. The recommended rate's about 20 pounds per acre. That's a little bit higher than 20 pounds per acre. So 20 pounds per acre is just fine. You know, your average cost is probably going to be $100 to $150 to plant it. You don't need to put fertilizer, but you can fertilize this and it'll just increase seed yield. I have also heard of folks even going in and fertilizing moist soil plants. Okay, and so you could try that. You could do some spot areas and see what the production is just on your area if you had some extra fertilizer. I've heard it works. Generally, with respect to planting agriculture within moist soil areas, you're planting them up at the higher elevations of an impoundment. Again, they tend not to be able to deal with moisture as well as hydrophytes. And once you get into agricultural plants, such as corn, you certainly want to make sure you're up at the higher elevations of an impoundment. And maturation time of millet. I'm not sure Japanese millet. I was looking up pearl millet, which is another one. And its maturation time is 75 to 110 days. So, you know, you're talking anywhere from, you know, 2.5 months to 3.5 months time that you really need to have. So, you know, July, August, September is certainly plenty of time. You could get away with planting. I wouldn't plant any later than maybe the second week of August, but you can drill this stuff. This area, I think, was drilled, but you can also just come into an area and broadcast seed. And you can do this. You can send a technician out. There's things, you know, you put on the back. There's broadcast seed spreaders on the back of a four-wheeler. There's ones that are just hand crank ones where you walk around and, you know, on a mud flat and, you know, and spread seed, so you can do it either way. Okay, so now we're kind of transitioning into agriculture. And this is a little schematic here. And you might think about this schematic with maybe a couple of your impoundments. So you have your moist soil area here. And actually the whole area, maybe the moist soil may even come up into this area. But up in the upper elevations, you have some agricultural plots. You could be, here I have, I've indicated or pictorially represented three different types of crops. It's not necessary, but they really are meeting the needs of different types of birds. You have corn that's in the center, a center strip. And then on one side, you have, you're planting some type of like winter wheat that's going to function as a green browse prior to it being flooded for grazing geese. And then on the other side, you could have millet, or another agricultural crop is buckwheat, which I have on another slide, you know, with the scientific name here. So you could have that, or you could just have some strips of corn that were that were up in these upper areas, whatever you wanted to do. The point is, though, is that your agricultural plots should be in close proximity to moist soil. Your goal is to basically keep waterfowl, keep the agricultural crops, which have high seed yield, close to your natural moist soil areas, which can be high in seed yield, but also have aquatic invert. So ultimately, the birds don't have to fly as much going from point A to point B between agricultural sites and natural sites. Here's a good picture of basically moist soil right next to a corn strip. And you can imagine that's flooded up. Boy, the birds will be in there in that moist soil, then they can swim right into the corn. And they will swim into standing corn and eat it. But again, it'll have to be up to a level where they can reach those ears. Geese will be able to, you know, you have a foot of water in there, and geese will be able to reach. In fact, I've seen geese even walk into corn and that's not even flooded and eat the corn right off the stalk if the ears aren't too high. They do have some corn is now available. It's like a dwarf corn that basically has about the same seed yield, but the ears start just like a foot or so off the ground. That'd be awesome, you know, if you get a hold of that type of corn, or that type of seed. This is a picture from Kaminsky. He is a promoter of what is called dirty corn. And he calls it dirty corn because that's what the farmers call it. They just think it looks completely ugly. That look in between these rows, those are all beautiful moist soil plants. And this is no-till corn. So you can come in here and do no-till corn, put some fertilizer on it in a moist soil area, and this is dynamite. This is the best of all worlds right here. Now, this would be on a WMA where you're not going to harvest this corn. A lot of times, if you're on a WMA or you're on a wildlife refuge, a lot of times you end up working into a share crop type arrangement where the farmer comes in, he plants corn here, or she, and then in front of it they may plant it like soybeans or some other crop, or the whole field may be corn, and then they come in and they harvest and strip for you. Now, you don't have to worry about sharecropping with your question that I'm giving you, okay? Just go ahead and assume that you have enough money to do whatever you want to do, and there aren't any restrictions. I want you to be able to think creatively. And then later on, when you get a job, reality will restrict your creativeness. It always does. But that's reality. Okay, so this is really awesome. This is an awesome situation. You can just go in and no-till right within your moist soil impoundment. And again, I don't recommend this all the way across the impoundment, just up in the upper zones. This is also great for hunting. If you're a duck hunter and you're standing within here, it's good cover. And they make, you know, corn-striped camouflage for standing in corn and all that stuff. And it is legal, again, to go and hunt over. If you go and bush hog this stuff, it's illegal, but and hunt over it. You're not hunting over anything. You can bush hog. In fact, many refuges knock down corn. They bush hog corn. And that is a good way to make it available to birds if you're not hunting over it. One other thing is, with respect to bush hogging and knocking down corn, even on a refuge, is a refuge can be cited for baiting if birds are being shot going to that area. So if you have a hunting club that is adjacent to you, you have to make sure that if you have an area that you're knocking down corn, you're bush hogging corn or some other crop, that they can't shoot at those birds. In other words, if you had a hunting club around you, I wouldn't be doing that type of practice, at least the knocking down or bush hogging of corn or agricultural crop anywhere near them. Okay? Flood it up, that's fine, or if it's again natural combine or natural combine, if it's combine. But so the point in ultimately, this might be a point that I had on the review sheet from last year, why have agricultural crops in close proximity to natural wetlands is they can acquire high energy grains, agricultural grains, without flying long distances. That helps them conserve energy and foremost. Secondly, it reduces their probability of ultimately experiencing mortality, whether it's through a predator, avian predator, or it's actually at the end of a gun. Of course, you may have the goal of attracting birds in so they can be harvested, even so, you'd rather have birds being harvested on your management area instead of somebody else's area, so the bird centrally located. The other important aspect of refuge. And refuge should have some of these good feeding areas. Shouldn't just be, you know, crappy stuff. Okay? Late successional stuff or whatever. Geese will certainly get in here and eat corn. And they also are grazers. So you can have some upland sites that aren't even flooded. They could just be upland terrestrial sites that that you plant to winter wheat or, well, whatever. They'll get in there and they'll eat it. Okay. Another common plant that is planted for, or crop that is planted for waterfowl, especially as you go farther south, once you get into the more rice-growing areas, is rice. And rice is a water-loving plant, so it really works well in wetlands. You almost manage this thing like a moist soil. And you have good moist, good rice production. You should put water on it during the growing season. It helps reduce, reduce weed competition. But if you're doing it for waterfowl, you almost really don't even need to irrigate rice. And then you flood these up. And again, what you should do is flood up slowly, as with everything else. And whatever's in front of your standing crop here should be something. Either that's going to be harvested, maybe a harvested crop if you're doing sharecropping, but there's still going to be waste grain there. There's still going to be some there. The ducks will get in there and eat that waste grain. Or this may be moist soil, so let them take advantage of that moist soil. Let them eat all that seed and bring it up nice and slow. Take a month and a half before you hit the top to a depth, which is going to be probably about 2 to 3 feet, honestly. It's going to be about thigh deep by the time ducks can get up to a lot of those ears. So once you hit up there, you know, maybe a month later, then they can really get to those high energy foods. I'm telling you ideal situations, and it gets pretty darn political and hot when you start to talk with waterfowl hunters. And I'll tell you what, they all know how to manage ducks better than you. They do. They'll every single one of them tell you how to manage and what you're doing is wrong. So I mean, things can get kind of dicey when you're out there, and you have to be really good at managing those types of questions, educating the hunters in the importance of slow flooding, etc. And just tell them why you're doing these different things. I mean, it's to create good, just say, believe in me. It's to create good waterfowl opportunities. Remember, and be proud of this, you all are the ones sitting in the classroom, not them. You know, they decided to do whatever they wanted to do, right? And you all are here studying and learning about the biology of the animals and how to manage for them. So you don't need to flaunt that, but at the same time, use that power and that confidence to let folks know what you know. So, I mean, outside of ducks and everything, whatever you're managing. Although, you know, everybody really in here should manage ducks, in my opinion, but or amphibians. Okay, anything that deals with wetlands. Okay, so other common agricultural crops are grain sorghum or milo, soybeans. Soybeans, we'll see here, is really not a good crop to plant for waterfowl. It decomposes very quickly. It doesn't have a whole lot of energy. But it's often planted in a sharecropping situation. Again, where the farmer may be taking the soybeans, keep leaving the corn for you. Brown top millet's good, and common buckwheat's another good one that's planted frequently. Any questions? Now, why not just plant everything to corn? Why not just do that? I'm going to show you some estimates here about yields, and we'll compare those yields with moist soil production. I'll tell you right now, the yield from a cornfield as far as seed production is a heck of a lot higher than the yield in a moist soil area. Well, there's several reasons why not just to plant agricultural grains. And this is one of the first ones right here, is that first of all, waterfowl cannot sustain their body weight and correspondingly cannot survive on eating agricultural food alone. They did not evolve to survive on agricultural grains. So they are something missing in agricultural grains. And this graph is one of the first studies Kaminsky did when he was a new professor at Mississippi State. And they had some waterfowl that they had in a captive facility. And they basically fed them a variety of things from November through February, basically the time that late November through February when ducks are usually in Mississippi in the south. And they looked at how their body weight changed over time, and that's what the y-axis is. And at the top here, you have a control diet, which is got everything that they need. It's like a Purina duck chow or something. And then here is millet, okay? So you can see that pretty much it's tracking pretty closely the control. Then you get to rice, which is a little bit lower. Then you get to corn, and then you get to soybean. And you can really see that the weights are dropping. They're not able to maintain their body weights over time. And the treatment period ended here, and everybody got duck chow, and then everybody's body weight just jumped up, and they were fine. So a couple things. Again, agricultural diets alone will not sustain ducks. Secondly, even if they are nutritionally starved, okay, they can respond if they get, and their body weight can respond. They're pretty plastic, and they'll respond and increase their body weight when they get around good habitat. So, let's see here. And the other point to notice is that rice and millet certainly were better than corn and soybean. And so these were mallards, I guess, metabolize less energy from soybeans than all other grains. That's the other point to make. Soybeans are really not very good at all. And, they had an idea of some trypsin inhibitor that might prevent them from metabolizing soybeans very well. So this is a quote from Kaminsky and one of his grad students, Chuck Lesh, former grad student. So waterfowl cannot maintain body weight in agricultural seed alone. So that's one reason right there. Okay. Second reason, which I don't even know if I have, is that in agricultural areas, when you flood those areas up, the invertebrate production is very, very low. It's almost nothing. Okay. Compared to moist soil areas, which has pretty good production. And so they're getting lots of inverts in moist soil areas. I will mention here, we're going to talk about yield, but the average amount of energy in moist soil seeds is 2.5 kilocalories per gram. You might remember that from last week. Average for agricultural seed, not including soybeans, so like this, I think this value here is rice and corn, is 3.5 kilocalories per gram. Not only, they're getting a lot of energy from seed, but it's also lacks many of the important minerals, etc., that they get in moist soil seeds. So lots of energy, but a bunch of ice cream has lots of energy, but you can't survive on ice cream alone. Okay, you need some meat and potatoes. Any questions on that one? Okay, here's another reason why not to just plant agricultural grains and flood them up. This is percent deterioration over 90 days of flooding, over 3 months of flooding, and for different plants down here, crops and moist soil plants. After 3 months of flooding, soybeans, 86% of them have been decomposed. So, and if you look here, corn's up there. Actually, jat millet and pearl millet also decompose relatively quick. Grain sorghum. And then once you get down to the moist soil seeds here, where you have paspalum, that is, I forget the common name of what you all have for that. Knotgrass, okay. Cesbania there, smartweed. So your millets your panic grasses, lather grasses, all those are going to be down here about 10% decomposition or so after 90 days of flooding. So very few of those resources, they're being maintained. So when you flood them, whatever's there is pretty much staying there. When you flood agricultural grains, they're decomposing relatively quickly. And if they're just a waste grain itself, like you saw from Melissa's stuff, I think I might have some slides here, really disappears quick. So if it's just laying on the surface, it germinates very quick and it decomposes quick. So that's another thing. If you're thinking about bush hogging or knocking down agricultural crops, wait until you're ready to do it. Wait till the birds are there. Because as soon as it hits the ground, it's not going to stay there very long, unless it's snowing out. Okay. You do see here, rice is an agricultural grain here, and it's down towards the moist soil area. But again, that's kind of domestic rice. There's wild rice, so it's just domesticated and kind of more of a moist soil plant just naturally. So. So moist soil seeds decompose more slowly and retain their nutritional quality longer than agricultural grains. So a second reason, really a third reason, because then we have aquatic inverts too. Sounds like a test question, doesn't it? All right, let's talk a little bit about waste grain. And the research that Melissa is doing really came out of two studies that were done in Mississippi by a couple of Kaminsky's former grad students, Scott Manley and Josh Stafford, looking at the waste grain in harvested rice fields. And one thing they documented is that post-harvest on the ground, there was around 270 kilograms per hectare of seed. But by late autumn, when the birds got there, lots of things were happening to the seed over time. Very similar to Melissa's case. Now, there's a value that you may remember from Melissa's presentation called the giving up density. It is a theoretical threshold, but there is some empirical evidence that suggests that once food resources drop below 50 kilograms per hectare, birds, waterfowl tend to abandon those areas, probably because it just becomes energetically inefficient for them to try to continue to find food resources. It becomes scarce. The theoretical threshold is based on optimal foraging theory, but there is now empirical evidence that supports that around that level, indeed, the birds do seem to abandon sites. So in at least harvested rice fields, again, what's left out there after the combine goes over is quite a bit, but by the time the ducks get there, it's very close to this critical threshold, so functionally, it doesn't take very long before it's really the food that's out there is going to be below levels that the birds are going to use. So, let's see here. I'm not sure what I was talking about there. Okay, so what happens to the seed? They did a similar study that Melissa did as far as fate, and most of the rice seed was decomposing. Okay, some of it was getting eaten and some of it was germinating, and then there was just about 20% that was available at the end. So the bottom line is now I remember what this is. This number here, this 50, 140 per hectare, was what was assumed to be left in the fields by biologists based on previous work that had been done in the 80s. Okay, well, you can see that this is quite a bit less. The 78 is quite a bit less than 140. And so the thought is probably some of the things driving less food now compared to the 80s is probably more efficient combines now. The other thing is with all of our crops, and especially rice, they have there are varieties that mature very quickly. And so now rice is being harvested much earlier than it was in the 80s. So seed is being left out there for longer periods of time, and correspondingly, lots of different things can happen. So earlier harvest and more efficient harvest, probably contributing to these lower numbers. Yeah. Okay, so when does it go from available to decompose? Available seed is, it's intact still. It has a capability of germinating ultimately. Decomposed, if you grab decomposed seed and you actually squeeze it, it just is mush. The nutritional value decreases rapidly in decomposed seed, yeah. Okay, any questions there? So here's some results. You've seen some of these results from Melissa's study, but we'll just rehash those since now you may have a pen in your hand. So these are her 2005 results. Heck, I don't even remember what she may have presented 2006 results, I don't remember. But this is for corn. This is right at post-harvest. You can see this is kilograms per hectare, 300 kilograms per hectare. Do y'all remember the average amount of seed production in a moist soil area? 500, exactly, good memory. So average is 500 kilograms per hectare. Now, if you're doing your job, you can keep that can be closer to 1,100 kilograms per hectare in early succession, okay? And then certainly, if you're getting towards later succession, you know, it'll be around 200 kilograms per hectare. So just as a kind of a benchmark for you. So right at post-harvest, there's actually quite a bit of corn that's being left out there. So around 300 kilograms per hectare, but that disappears very quickly. 1 month post-harvest, 2 months post-harvest, and we drop below that 50 kilogram per hectare threshold in a harvested corn field after 2 months post-harvest, okay? So basically 3 months post-harvest, you're below that threshold. I'd remember those durations. So you're dropping below it. See, at 2 months you're still above. See, at 3 months you're below. So I'll probably at 2.5 months yet. And soybean tends to be less that's left out. 10 kilograms per hectare. And you can see just after 1 month post-harvest, boom, you're below the 50 kilogram per hectare threshold. Grain sorghum, quite a bit of seed left post-harvest, 500 kilograms per hectare here. But you drop below that very quickly, 2 months post-harvest, about, you know, probably 1.5 months post-harvest, you're below the 50 kilograms per hectare. Is Mila. Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah. All right. So the recommendation is, at least on a WMA, if you can work with, if you have to harvest, okay, just as late as possible. If you're working with a sharecropper, ask them if they can. Well, just go ahead and, usually they're sharecropping on your WMA, and then they have their own lands that they're combining on. See if they can cut your stuff the latest. Because obviously, you know, there's always some seed out there 1 month post-harvest, but pretty quickly it disappears. Now, you don't need to flood these areas up. Upland sites that have harvested crops will be used by waterfowl, ducks and geese. My point here was these were the decomposition rates, and after 90 days, there's 86%, you know, soybeans are gone, and corn was 50%, and sorghum was 42% after 90 days of flooding. And I think my point here is actually Melissa's testing this right now, but is that you can see that even it used to just be thought that, well, if you flooded an area, well, things decompose rapidly. Seed decomposes rapidly. But from just these preliminary data that Melissa has, it appears that seed is disappearing much faster on the landscape. Well, that makes sense. Remember, when you flood things, decomposition decreases in rate, okay? Because we're going from aerobic to anaerobic respiration. Plus, when you flood it, if it's not flooded, it can also germinate, and it can also be eaten by stuff. But if you flood it, for the most part, you're not going to have germination. Decomposition is going to be reduced. And yeah, there might be some things that are eating it, water birds, or, you know, some aquatic inverts will eat seed too. But probably not as many granivores there or non-waterfowl granivores as there are in a terrestrial setting. So I guess the point is if you have upland sites that are harvested, try to delay harvest as much as possible. And you almost could flood these things if you had flooding capabilities, and probably decomposition rates will be slower. But. Okay, so here are some standing crop estimates for comparison. For corn, 8,200 kilograms per hectare. For soybean, 3,800 kilograms per hectare. And for grain sorghum, 2,200 kilograms per hectare. So this yield is something to respect and to appreciate, because this is why you plant food plots. Because the yield is very high, it is higher than natural wetlands, and they're high in energy. But the seed itself is missing many of the important nutritional requirements of waterfowl, and invertebrate production is poor. So have food plots as opposed to continuous impoundments that are just planted to agriculture. And again, if you're in early succession, you're about half the production of grain sorghum, which is still, in my opinion, pretty darn impressive, you know, in comparison to, you know, agricultural grains that we've engineered so they produce lots of seed, and these are all fertilized and everything, and they're herbicide and all the stuff, okay? So This production will probably be less if, well, it would be less probably in a no-till situation where you're just, for wildlife, and you may not be fertilizing it much or putting much herbicide on it or pesticide or whatever. So these are estimates from agricultural production fields throughout Tennessee. Okay. Any questions? Oh, last thing, don't plant soybeans for a food plot for ducks. Again, if you have to have it out there for sharecropping, fine. But if you're going to choose something, choose corn or choose sorghum or the millets that I mentioned, those agricultural varieties, or buckwheat. So, yeah, you can flood these areas up and ducks and geese respond. They also use, again, harvested fields. This is in Michigan. And, I mean, these geese are right out here in the snow. You know, they get a search image for a harvested field, and they'll just land in the snow and start picking around looking for grain. So they can be incorporating agriculture into moist soil management can be a very effective technique. And that really, that process, Kaminsky has really kind of led that endeavor. Lee Fredrickson is a father of moist soil management, but Lee was always very hesitant about recommending using agriculture, and I think he is more now, but Kaminsky was really kind of forged the way forward, saying, you know what, we can blend these things together and have some areas where you have dirty corn, okay, and they can be excellent waterfowl are excellent sites for waterfowl to use and forage in, and ultimately provide harvest opportunities if that's the goal of your area. If that is the goal of your area, you need to think about having and allowing hunting access. And the last two handouts I have, one again is the two figures you already saw, one with, you know, Kaminsky's thing and this other decomposition one. You need to think about having access, and this is the last one I guess I have here, as far as providing access to hunting areas. You should have walk-in ramps, that's what these are showing, and a map to show, okay, this is how you get into these sites. These strips here are actually in between, this is at Shiawassee State Game Area up in Michigan. They have strips of corn here. There are zones that you can go and you hunt for, and you actually draw for these zones. In between, it's share crops. So it's in between, they have harvested whatever the crop is. They may in front of it have a strip of buckwheat that's been planted too as part of the share cropping agreement, or a strip of millet. And so having good directions, et cetera, and all that type of stuff, and allowing access. Where you do have levees, having these types of pullover sites designated so that there always is traffic just in one area, and so your levees aren't torn apart, is pretty important. Having these types of ramps here where you can pull your boat over, or again, if you're just walking in, you can have foot access in. And in some areas, they'll even have hand winches and stuff like that to help folks get their boats over. So they may have a hand winch at the top to, or a power winch or something. Okay. So this handout here, you can see for Shiawassee, really has lots of information for the hunters. Now, one thing we don't talk about is, you know, what about access, and what are different options you can do for access? How should you set up hunts? Should you, a common tradition in Tennessee is that many of the WMAs, you draw one time, and that is it for a zone, and that is your zone for the entire season. Well, in contrast, like at Shiawassee, they have drawings twice a day, a morning hunt and an afternoon hunt, 7 days a week. So, I don't know. You can reflect on that and make a decision which is providing the most opportunities for hunting for the citizens of those respective areas. And I would suggest that if you only have one drawing and it's one group of folks that get a blind all year, you're not serving probably your area to the best of your capabilities. Unfortunately, that is TWRA is probably aware of that situation, but unfortunately local politics have resulted in these types of traditions being established in many West Tennessee WMAs where that type of situation occurs. And those folks have political connections and pick up the phone pretty quickly, and they've been pretty hesitant or in opposition of changes to maybe weekly draws or daily draws. And certainly you also have to have the manpower to be able, the personnel power to be able to do that. But anyways, those are some things to think about. You know, you can manage, you can create refuges. The other thing just to consider, you can have a refuge in a spatial context like this where nobody's allowed in. And you can also have what I call temporal refuges where you can only hunt certain days of the week. So the entire area becomes a refuge for you know, half of the days of a week. And that is a way to provide resources for the birds and also create good hunting opportunities, because you can catch the birds off guard. And so you have birds come in, they use an area, they think that it's okay, then you come the next day and you're able to shoot and harvest those birds, but then you're out the next day. And so it can really create some very good hunting opportunities. And so all I do is encourage you to be creative and thinking about hunter access, and be also aware that there's a lot of traditions that are out there, not only in Tennessee, but in other states, that might prevent you from, at least in your opinion, managing to the best of your ability. But that's kind of the human dimensions component. Any questions? My mentor, Dr. Rick Kaminsky, or one of my mentors, and Dr. Bob Cox, who's a retired USGS waterfowl biologist, and a bunch of birds they shot out in the Prairie Pothole region. Got some ringnecks up there too. Any questions? Yeah. Okay, so on the refuge area, you knocked it down?
Just where it's grown.
Okay. Well, birds that are coming to that site, to that baited site, I mean, that's technically, that is baiting, period. So you can't hunt over it. So if there is evidence, this comes down to a game warden making the decision. If they're sitting there and watching birds that are flying to that baited area, being shot by folks around the baited area, even if they're not right over top of it, then that is baiting, okay? Any other questions? Okay, so let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll talk, oh yeah, Yeah. I guess we'll talk about this here. Let's take a 5-minute break, though. This is your take-home. Do at the test, the written test, so it'll be the Tuesday that we're leaving for Mississippi, the 24th or so. So you have all over. No, it's over spring break. You'll have over spring break to think about this. Yeah, if you want to come on up and grab this, then we'll, after the little break here, we'll talk about it.